All right, so this topic I've been thinking about for a long time. I actually it's part of a it was part of a book project that I started about, well, I've been researching it 15 years ago, and it was a book on foreign policy that took me 15 years to research and then 7 years to write that Routledge actually canceled when I wrote my infamous pro-Israel piece in the Federalist 3 years ago. They promptly canceled my contract. And so 700 pages of 15 years of work got canceled, which is good because it gives me a chance to cut it down to 300 pages. But this was actually chapter 10 of a chapter 10 of a title of the book called Moral Rogue Nation States, Failed States, and the Destruction of Political Happiness. So I really began thinking about this connection between failed states and rogue states, and how they manage to really compromise people's capacity to achieve both personal happiness. And then I began thinking of political happiness, which was a term I think Hannah Arendt developed. Well, she toyed with it, but I'm not sure that she really developed it fully. So I thought it would be interesting to sort of develop this notion of political happiness, which I can't exhaust in a 20, I intend to take about 20 minutes to talk about it. But to sort of just like abstractly flesh it out. But first, talk about why the idea of a rogue state is completely inimical. What is a rogue state, and why a rogue state is inimical to any form of what I'm going to say is political happiness. So when we talk about a rogue state, we're really talking about a state that violates the foundational letter or spirit of the law that binds, the moral league of moral nations of the world. That is, they are states that violate free trade and free markets, human rights and individual rights, gender and racial equality, bodily integrity, either constitutional republics or democracies, and transparent governance, freedom of association and of religious affiliation without persecution, the right to one's conscience and the judgments thereof, freedom of speech and freedom of the press, freedom of association, the right of each individual to cultivate a life plan that corresponds to his or her rational choices, and the values in the name of personal autonomy, that is, the right to acquire property and the right to have one's property rights protected. So moral rogue states reify the spirit of, among other things, the spirit of anarchy that characterizes the global commons, by failing, among other things, to ratify the international political sphere with treaties, laws, protocols, proliferations, referenda that would add law and order to it in a way that secures a lasting peace for all of us. So we can make sense of the term even before President Clinton became the first, I think, to give it its first coinage in 1994 in Brussels, by reference to historical behavior of any state that behaved with belligerence and with without impunity towards other states. So the idea of a rogue state presupposes some semblance of order and established customary law in the public imaginary and in the international public sphere. Now, traditionally, there have been four transgressive criteria that have been used to determine the nature of a rogue state. In theory, a state had to, one, pursue weapons of mass destruction, support terrorism, severely abuse its own citizens, and virulently oppose or criticize the United States. So throughout the history of US foreign policy, the latter has revised its conception of a rogue state, depending on political expediency and the shifting criteria that are used to determine who is or is not an ally. So Saudi Arabia, which is the second largest sponsor of terrorism through its Wahhabi faith, is not classified, has not been classified as a rogue state, but it's clearly a rogue state given that it kills more Americans than any other countries in the world, and routinely abuses citizens through beheadings, trials without representation, absence of due process, etc. What is clear is that the definition of a rogue state advanced by the United States under several administrations over the past decades fails to capture the subtlety of behaviors exhibited by several states and nations that ought to still render them subsumable under the label rogue states. But a rogue state really is one that de-ratifies the structural alignment of human moral personalities from their foundational axis, and the essence of its moral violence is divestiture of the entire juridical personality of persons by foisting a political system or morality that is antithetical to man's nature qua man. So I just want to talk about what I mean by moral violence and then go on to talk about the nature of political happiness. So when I talk about moral violence, I'm talking about the systematization and politicization of mores, beliefs, attitudes, and schemas that are codified into ways of legally dismantling the coherency of the self by legally prohibiting the individual from creating life plans in the free service of his or her life. It is the legal imposition of soul-killing anti-life plan through authoritarianism, totalitarianism, dictatorship, Sharia law, on individuals who have no choice but to contest it and no opportunity to negotiate an alternative. All right, so rogue states in some sense are antithetical to the rational construction of a life plan and are antithetical to what I'm going to call is political happiness. Okay, so onto political, a sketch of what I mean by political happiness. So what does it mean to say that one enjoys political happiness by living within the geographic demarcation and sovereign jurisdiction of a nation state or a nation or a state? I think at minimum it means that one enjoys a certain degree of confidence in the state to execute its duties with regard to all citizens. On some level, a thin conception of such duties would be the basic protection of the individual rights of each citizen. That is the unassailable and inviolable protection of bodily integrity, right? That as I've said previously, the failed state does not protect bodily integrity. The prohibition of any arbitrary use of force against an individual and any initiation of force by the state against others. The protection of his property and his right to pursue the private property, ownership of property as a sort of metaphysical concomitant of the use and application of one's reason to what Rand would call the problem of human survival, which a rogue state certainly does not protect, and the free exercise of one's consciousness, of one's conscience, and the right to hold whatever ideas one deems to result from the thinking one has done, or in a free society, from what one has failed to do. The state cannot compel an individual to think. In a free society, the state only can refuse to save the individual from the consequences of not thinking. Freedom of association, freedom of religious affiliation and worship, freedom to marry whomever one chooses to marry without state discrimination based on race, ethnicity, gender, nationality, or religious affiliation, and all inalienable rights enjoyed by citizens under the liberal states are those conditions which allow persons to interface with the state in a way that allows them to trust the state to protect the basic conditions, social conditions that are required for their survival as human beings. So political happiness, as I'm thinking about it, and as I was thinking about it 10 years ago when I first started the book, is a condition of experienced well-being in the liberal polity. And this well-being and eventual flourishing can only be guaranteed with the requirements of one's nature as a human being when they are politically secured by the state in the form of rights that are enshrined and protected constitutionally, which of course the failed state and the rogue state certainly does not do. And this enactment on the part of the state engenders confidence in the citizens, and we can say that this confidence is the first mark of a form of political happiness. So when people talk about social cohesion and political trust, right, they're talking about expressions of political happiness. Social cohesion and political trust are nothing more than the manifestations or the expressions or the forms that result as a result of people feeling political happiness. You can't have political happiness unless there is social cohesion and political trust. So they're all parasitic on a negative conception also of liberty that's rooted in a society. If I had time, I would go on to explain why a positive conception of liberty, like the right to basic income, the right to an education, all these positive rights are actually inimical to positive, to political happiness. But maybe I'll save that for another time. So the respect of and the upholding of our rights create a space and the social conditions where citizens can literally enjoy each other as compatriots, friends, and allies. And the space where the social conditions of rights are met allows citizens to breathe and to interact without an aura of suspicion and a spirit of resentment. And I'm going to unpack this. Why is this the case? Because laws are objective and transparent, and rights are notable and obvious, and each is deemed equal before the law, even if we're not metaphysically equal, which we certainly are not, and even if we're not equal in terms of income distribution, which in a free society, that just simply cannot be the case. The constitutional liberal state, unlike the rogue state and the abysmal failed state, allows for play and a state of becoming and continued moral evolution among the citizenry, in spite of the disparities that exist among individuals. So each becomes what I would call causally co-imbricated in the life plans of the other by means of a loose network of intercalated systems. And this is because of, in a constitutional republic such as ours, we have a system of capitalism where, I'm going to use Kantian terms here, we will the ends of others through free trade, through voluntary association. We will what Kant would call, although Kant wouldn't be agreeing with what I'm saying here, a kingdom of ends of other people through voluntary association, voluntary trade. So each celebrates this sort of systemic relationality among the co-imbricated nature of life, because the nature of rights and objective laws create the separateness and distance among human beings for each to cultivate a degree of independence and individuation that all forms of mature lives are called to perform. So I think that political happiness is what I would call a dialectical relationship between a separateness born of individuality and the participation forged in escapability of shared interests, common ties, and bounded activities that constitute a common civic and public life, and also a shared, a distinct private life. And the resultant self is a compound individual where agency become constituted not by closed-ended communal relationship, but what I would call multitudinous relationships with relevant, significant others. That is, those who pose, I think in Randian terms, value relevance to one's life and one's existence. So political happiness on this account is an ability to achieve a degree of fluency between the self executing the life plan one has called for oneself and the relationship one has to the state, because the state has fulfilled its role obligation of leaving the individual free to pursue his life plans or her life plans. And secondly, by actively providing the socio-political infrastructures and the juridical machinery to ensure that such issuances of life plans are not episodic, but systemic ways of life for each individual. So political happiness cannot be the state mandating a conception of the good for the individual and the attendant good life emanating from such a conception, nor can it be an individual struggling to carve out a good life against oppressive strictures and mandates of a state that has configured a different version of the good for its citizens, or in the case of failed states or rogue states, cannot provide even a thin material state apparatus for the protection of such conceptions of the good life. Right? So paradoxically, political happiness can't consist in the state protecting your conception of your good life, because that's a violation of liberty. So political happiness is not simply a relationship one has with oneself and with one's compatriots. It is simply an ability to cultivate, among other things, a life plan not blocked by the state. So it is fundamentally a reciprocal give and take relationship with the state, where the liberal state, acting as an employee of the citizen, negotiates the terms of its employment through a series of contested activities that are ratified and endorsed by the citizens. And the citizen is ultimately mistress and master in her and his own house, and happiness comes from the degree of control and autonomy that is exercised in that house. And freedom in the house of the liberal state is not a luxury granted by the state, but a profound requirement of the nature of man, of the individual, based on his indubitable sui generis nature. And I would say that freedom and its corollaries is a metaphysical concomitant of life, whose alternative, as we see in failed states and rogue states, is death. And I say this against the backdrop of accrued executive powers that we're seeing being exercised by governors and state legislators who, say in the case of abortion, are now becoming not employees, but are becoming our bosses, and defining, for example, issues that should be left to the individual, like conceptions of when personhood begins, like governors and state legislators defining personhood as beginning in the embryonic state of fetal development. So the judgment of our servants cannot supersede ours in a way that compromises our ability to make sense of the good lives that we have carved out for ourselves. I'm almost done. So in a state in which the state actively discriminates against minorities like blacks or women, or any minority, such as the individual, as Rand said, another condition which makes it challenging for political happiness to be achieved is the fact that the moral reputation of citizens under a de jure discriminatory state suffers in a way that undermines what I would call political self-esteem. So residents cannot enjoy a robust and healthy moral reputation because by association with a bigoted state, they also take on its, let's say, racist identity and the promulgated ethos that comes from such an identity. So persons from a racially bigoted state, such as the United States before, I would say, the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, are thought to suffer along with their representative political actors and are complicit as citizens from some sort of arrested political development. They're just congenitally incapable of getting their acts together, goes the reasoning. And cognitively, they have failed to achieve some semblance of moral standing in relation to the constitutional ideals laid out in the governing documents for all persons. So a conferral of moral deficiency is imposed on them, and concomitantly, I believe that this lacunae in their perceived agency leave them bereft of the requisite recognition that shores up their political self-esteem. And political happiness is thusly compromised. There is so much more. This is all abstract, and there's so much more that I want to say, but it's 4:19, and I said I would see Jennifer. I'm very punctual. I said I would take no more than 20 minutes, because, and I'm 1 minute short of my goal, because I do want more of this to come out, probably in the questions. So at exactly 4:20, I have stopped.
Okay. Wonderful. Very, very interesting. I want to encourage all of you in the room, please share this discussion, share it on Clubhouse, share it on social media, and raise your hand. Let's get a conversation going. This is a wonderful opportunity to ask your questions of our senior scholar, Jason Hill. John, lovely to see you here.
Professor Hill, again, that is profound. I mean, it's a tour de force. It's really good thinking. And I it's a crime that your book was suppressed. Man, that's really good. The one thing that I was thinking about, which I think you touched on, and I'm sure you have a good answer, is the interface between the individual and other individuals, and then how that reconciles with the state that presumably somehow they give a silent, some kind of assent to, or silent consent it's that would be the area where I would need a little more fleshing out. Thank you.
Right. Yeah. Thanks, John. So this is very interesting because I think capitalism, as Rand properly recognized, and of course von Mises and other thinkers, but Rand was the one who really gave a moral justification for capitalism and not defended it based on some sort of social expediency or social utility value, recognized that. I don't think she would use the word socialization. In fact, I think she was against the term socialization. I would take disagreement with her here. But let's just use another term, you know, that it's through our interaction with our compatriots, our fellow human beings, that we morally grow, that we develop, we matriculate, we share our values. I would say also that we not only share our values, that we sometimes acquire new values by emotionally changing in ways. And I'll give an example. We hold certain attitudes, we hold certain beliefs, and through our exchange with our friends or through our exchange with associates, we come to have a change of heart about something, right? We come to have our ideas contested in a civil manner, and we have a change of view, separate and apart from intrusion by the state. So left to our own devices, so long as we're not violating each other's rights, I think I want to say that our political happiness is really, really dependent. And I guess Rand would say something, because I'm not that I'm trying to give a purely objectivist reading of political happiness, but I'm trying to have it be done in the spirit of what I think would be an objectivist idea of political happiness, is that that something like benevolence arises when we are free without reprisals from the state or without some sort of, you know, what's really going on in cancel culture and woke supremacist culture, where if we contest each other's feelings, where we lose our jobs or we're canceled or we offend each other, that there's a healthy dose of growth and a healthy dose of maturity that takes place without any interference on the part of the state. And, you know, I think it's something like Loving versus Virginia in 1967, where anti-miscegenation laws were, the Supreme Court universally, unanimously, I should say, struck down that case. It was one of the few cases in U.S. history where you had a unanimous ruling by the Supreme Court, where people could really form conceptions of the good life for themselves without any interference on the part of the state. Was a really, really good thing. And here we saw was a case where political happiness was increased because people were barred by, I think, I don't remember the name of the term, was sort of something, the Racial Integrity Act that was used in Virginia to prevent people from different races from getting married. So, and I know objectivists disagree with me here because I'm a defender of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, although I'm fully aware that it was a violation of property rights. But in my latest book, I really, really go out on a limb to argue why I think it was, given the collusion between the state and the citizenry, and how the state managed to produce racists out of non-racists. It was strategically a justified, I'm really going out on a limb here, violation that played a particular role in making non-racists out of racists. There are times when the state has a proper job of interfering when something is so egregiously wrong and evil, but those cases are quite rare. So I think the state should basically stay out of private affairs of people, and allow people to have disputes, allow people to interface with each other as they would like to interface with each other. And that is very, very, that freedom and that radical freedom is very, very conducive, I think, to what I'm taking to be a form of political happiness.
Thanks, Jason.
Sophomoric knowledge of Rand. My impression generally is that she doesn't really pound the drum of property rights and self-ownership as much as I would like, or the non-aggression principle, both principles seem like they're central to your thinking. Is that true?
Oh, I think, and David can chip in here, I think Rand pounds the issue of property rights more than I do. I mean, I think she was completely against the 1964 Civil Rights Act. She thought in that essay on racism that it was the most egregious violation of property rights that the country would witness.
Allow me to so backtrack. Let me back up. It's self-ownership is what I'm really talking about.
Oh, self-ownership. Okay.
That's what I mean. That's what I should have said.
She was pretty big on self-ownership too.
Yeah.
David, you want to chime in?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think Rand used the concept of self-ownership. She talked about the right to life, which in many ways comes to the same thing, but the self-ownership, idea goes back to Locke, who combined the rights of life, liberty, and property into a single concept of property. We own ourselves. And, you know, I think that's a great metaphor. But ownership, literally ownership means I have something distinct from myself that I own, control, have the right to use and dispose of. You can apply some of those terms to you know, to individuals, but I think it's at best a kind of metaphor. It's a very powerful and useful one, and I use it all the time. But in strictly speaking, I don't think it's the best way philosophically of making the point that individuals have the right to life, and which entails all the things that Jason was talking about under the heading of political happiness.
At risk of talking too much,
I do want to get our chairman in here.
Of course.
John, so if you wouldn't mind, I'm going to ask our chairman, Jay LaPere, to thank you for joining us, Jay.
Well, it's great to be here, as always, Jason. Fabulous. I did have a question. Reading your book, I became convinced of your position on the Civil Rights Act, but it was also tied to the idea that after that many years of government mandated segregation, that they needed to be kind of a jump start, for lack of using my language and not yours. And it would have then seemed to me to be proper to put a sunset on those requirements or the application of that law. Is that something you would have said, yeah, that makes sense, meaning after, you know, 100 years or some period of time, that would have to then say we've done it?
Thanks, Jay. Yes, absolutely. And I sort of hinted at that when I talked about the affirmative, all the sort of amendments and all the auxiliary measures that emanated from the 64 Civil Rights Act, that there has to be an expiry. It's such a violation of property rights that one would have to be really, really cynical and almost misanthropic vis-a-vis one's compatriots for it not to have an expiration date on it. That is, one has to say in good faith, look, we are beyond the pale of that sort of racism and bigotry in this country, that without calling for an outright repeal of the 64 Act, that we need to scale back on some of the what's entailed in there. And a prime example of this is religious liberty, in the sense that LGBT advocates who claim that they have a right to have their cakes baked by a religious owner. Surprisingly, I've come down on the, well, not so surprising, on the part of the bakery owners, and said that no, they do have a right to make those decisions on behalf, by exercising their conscience, and that you're free to go to somewhere else to have your cake baked. So Jay, I agree with you. I think that, as I call it in my book, it was a radical, radical eugenical moment in the history of America, where, you know, the state had manufactured racists, even out of non-racists. There were whites who wanted to rent rooms, hoteliers who wanted to rent rooms to blacks who just saw money, who saw green, and the state mandated these laws, highway interstate laws, that said you can't do this. So yes, there has to be some sort of expiration date on how far the trespassing on private property or on property rights can go. I personally think that we are quite the opposite, Jay. I think if you look now at our diversity, equity, and inclusion programs that are not just in academia but in corporations, and having worked in academia for 25 years, I can tell you that, you know, if you're a black person, especially a male, and you have a C+ average or a B- average, there's no college that will not send a jet plane for you. The progressivism that has taken over in this country is more pro-trans, more pro-black, which is not to say discrimination doesn't exist, but it does not exist on the systemic level that existed prior to 1964, where we did have systemic institutional racism.
Yeah, and I think the advantage of having a sunset would have also made clear that we're preserving the principle that government has no general right to interfere in the private sector and free choice among, you know, individual actors. So agreed. Thank you.
Yes, Jay. Thank you.
Yes, and Jason mentioned diversity, equity, and inclusion. I want to encourage everyone who is in California, in the Southwest, and maybe even a few who might want to travel from afar. We have added to the programming of our 6th annual gala, which is coming up on October 6th in Malibu. We're going to have a discussion between Jason Hill and Camille Foster that'll be moderated by Professor Stephen Hicks. So you won't want to miss that, in addition, of course, to our program of having Peter Diamandis present the Lifetime Achievement Award to Michael Saylor. So maybe we'll put a link up for discussion towards the end of the conversation. But and again, I want to encourage others, please raise your hand and join in the discussion. But Jason, maybe you could also, as we're waiting for others to raise their hand, share a little bit about what you've been going through at the university. The link that we previously had up there was about this controversy, efforts to cancel you. What happened and where does it stand now?
Right. Well, there was an article that was published today. A reporter did a story on me. I have a lawsuit against DePaul, as is probably well known, because it's been going on for 2 years, based on a very radically pro-Israel article that I wrote in The Federalist in 2019, defending Prime Minister Netanyahu's right, Israel's right, to defend its property, Judea and Samaria, which is quite often referred to as the West Bank. And I was censured in an illegal way. I was subjected to a lot of harassment and hostile work environment and a faculty-led boycott against my classes, among other things, just a great deal of. There were four lawsuits that were filed. The judge wrote three and kept the hostile work environment. Anyway, this woman, that was Ginger Hoffman, who circulated an email to about scores and scores of my colleagues saying that I came from a shithole country. So that was the article that was published today. And she found my defense of Israel horrific, and I can't remember the adjectives that she used. They're probably not worth repeating because they're probably not fit for discussion. But anyway, they were horrific and atrocious, and she said Jason Hill himself comes from a shithole country. And so the article was just outlining how hypocritical, you know, people on the radical left, well, not so radical, she's just a leftist professor, identified feminist, left-wing professor, can be. She actually told a lie, because Donald Trump, she tried to say that Donald Trump would have said that Jamaica was a shithole country. He never ever identified Jamaica as a shithole country. So she's lying on the former president just to sort of sneak across her viewpoint, which was to really harass me and to create a hostile work environment. Because I'm an advocate of a supporter of Israel as you know, a light in that region of the world, as the only democracy in that region of the world, as a really the only defender of individual rights in that region of the world. I continue to support Israel, and as just as an alter ego of America, actually. And so that's what the article is about. I encourage people to read it. It's on Twitter. It's all over Twitter. And
yeah, we put it up. It's the pinned link right now, so anybody interested can read it there.
Yeah.
So again, want to encourage you to raise your hand. There we go. Lawrence, do you have a question or a comment?
I do. Hi, Jason. So on the sort of nature of political happiness, one thing that I've been trying to revisit as of late has been sort of other definitions that we see of political societies. And through, you know, rereading Rousseau, he's very much returned to the primitive. There can be no form of political happiness. It's entirely unnatural. And at the same time, you have the utilitarians arguing that there's no individual right. We have to do the happiness for the most and the many. And just reading all these different views, what I guess, considering how you would call the woke supremacist act, on the one hand, there is this, at least they seem to say, we need to care for the many in that collective's definition. But at the same time, through their actions that they actually have, it seems to be more of just pure destruction, reversion, sort of like the Jacobins, back to a far more primitive state. And I'm curious if there's any central political thought, aside from everyone always saying, you know, cultural Marxism, are there other snippets from other thinkers that you can identify that are really pushing the woke supremacists today?
You mean historically speaking, or from the contemporaries? From the contemporary scene?
Because everyone seems to cite that cultural Marxism is what's influencing people today. Do you believe that more people are being influenced by utilitarian thinkers, or do you think it's more of people sort of appealing a bit to more Rousseau's ideas?
No, actually, you know, I don't know that this little man who was writing on behalf of a Swiss canton had that all that much influence. I would actually put Hegel before Rousseau, because I think that Hegel's reification and idealization of a state occupies much more of the global imaginary in the following way. That is, woke supremacists really, in some sense, are attempting, among other things, to inject a set of orthodox beliefs, have them codified, and have them be representative of some kind of a set of nationalistic tropes around which we should organize our lives and around which the state will sanction and the state will stamp it with the imprimatur of its authority. And the last resort of appeal will be the state. I find more of that coming out of Hegelian idealism and Hegelian, the extent to which Hegel really sort of idealizes the state and prioritizes where the state supersedes or precedes the individual much, much more than Rousseau. I mean, when I read Rousseau and I teach the not just the social contract theory, but the discourse on inequality, I just always shake my head and says, you know, I say, well, he's just writing with this little tiny Swiss canton, and there's no real application to a large heterogeneous society. So I place it more in line of the Hegelian conception of the state and all that's entailed by the reification of the state and the secondary role, the extent to which the individual gains his or her identity through identification with the state. If you look at the woke supremacists, they operate on that assumption. That is, they're not just private individuals who, so I'll give you an example and then I'll move it on to other people who want to say something. When I get emails from the administration saying, have you decolonized your syllabi? Have you removed all, and by that they mean, have you removed all dead white European males from your syllabi? I get this from the administration. All of us get this from the administration. When the woke supremacists tell me, Professor Hill, we like you as a professor, but we're not studying John Stuart Mill because he used to work for the East India Company. We're not studying Locke because he wrote the Constitution for the South Caroliners. And we're not really going to read Aristotle because he was a defender of slavery. This is really coming from the administration. This is coming from the provost's office. And when you look at the stuff coming through K through 12, these are all state-sanctioned imperatives. These are not, I mean, the woke schools, the private schools are not as woke as ever, because one thing about idea pathogens is that they're very, very infectious. They're very contagious. But they really are emanating from the state. And I think this is more in line with the Hegelian conception of the state than from Rousseau or from a utilitarian notion of maximization of happiness. I see that as pretty benign compared to what Hegel had in mind. I know Richard wanted to say something, if Richard wants to comment on that.
Well, I didn't want to comment, Jason. I just wanted to ask you a question about political happiness. And I'm thinking of a gap between personal happiness and political happiness. If happiness is, we typically call it the moral purpose of our life. By a gap, I think of, does your conception allow for the following? What about a case where some person or group of people are fundamentally unhappy in their personal lives, yet they live in a culture and a state that renders political happiness? It's a good state. It protects individual rights. So that would be a gap between the two. But the other one you can think of today, maybe, we all might be personally happy in our lives, but very disturbed about the surrounding political authoritarianism. So there's a gap there as well. And in the first case, I'm wondering whether you think the unhappy people or group could be helped by just living in a healthier society, you know, with a responsible behaving state. That's question one. And question two, in today's context, is there a kind of stoicism that the happy people today can choose to live to immunize themselves from the broader deterioration, you know, that there's not political happiness, but rather angst and antagonism being spread. And yet we want to create a little universe for ourselves and be happy. I don't know if that makes any sense, but you see what I mean about the gap between the personal and political happiness. I don't know if your concepts capture that or whether that's meaningful or not.
No, it's very, very meaningful. I mean, I think to answer the second question, it would take what Rand would say, you know, intellectual or not intellectual, but spiritual giants. And I think that, you know, I wake up every day and I feel, I suffer from hypomania. So I'm just, you know, I'm just moving, working, and take great joy from my vocational calling, which is to be a teacher and to be a writer. But periodically, I do feel politically depressed. I feel like this country is going to the dogs, and that we're in the last days of the Roman Empire. And I really feel that we're in a declinist register, and I feel politically depressed. My personal life, I'm happy with. My professional life, parts of my professional life are going well. But I do think that it takes a kind of spiritual heft to really maintain that kind of joie de vivre and that kind of sustained happiness, because the social goods, so to speak, to use a Rawlsian term, I'm not a Rawlsian, but the social goods that I need to not live this kind of compartmentalized life, but to just feel a sense of attunement and flow in my life is missing. But I do think that in order to be happy in one's personal life, one really needs to be ensconced in a political milieu which gives us the social goods to matriculate. And here I'm thinking about something like engagement, attunement. So when I think about attunement, I think of that as like my foundation in life. It occurs when the world appears as a secure rather than a hostile place. So when I feel like I'm attuned in my world, it feels like to be attuned is to be at home in my life. When I feel like I'm engaged in the world, it's engagement is built upon attunement. It's to be in the flow. I'm in the flow. To be engaged is to be consumed by the task at hand and to be absorbed by it, to become lost in activity because my energy levels rise and my self-consciousness sort of melts away, because the institutions and everything is working together. And I kind of have an absence of a self-consciousness about what I'm doing because everything is in harmony. And to endorse my engagement with life is to affirm it. It is to say a yes to a life that I'm leading. And I feel just a sort of contentment with things as they are, right? So it involves according a sense of success in the process, if not the outcome, with how things are going. And so it's hard for me to imagine how someone can be personally happy when, like, I don't see how anybody in Iran or Saudi Arabia, like a woman, could be personally happy. Maybe with a certain kind of consciousness that one has been socialized to live by. But I don't know how anybody can be personally happy if the political conditions under which you matriculate are abusive, are despotic, are invasive, are eviscerative of your dignity. But I do see where in a situation such as ours, where we are living in a semi-free, we're still free. We can say what we want. The First Amendment is still alive and well, thank God. You can still call out a conception of a good life for oneself although with Roe v. Wade, you know, that's changing. If contraception becomes illegal, and if sodomy laws get, back on the books, and all sorts of intrusive ways that the government privacy, you know. In other words, the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I think, are dependent on privacy. And if those things go out the window, then our ability to conceive a conception of the good life for ourselves become compromised. So I do think that the more, as I said, that our servants, our damn servants, our elected officials, these people are our maids. They're our servants. start acting like our bosses and start dictating to us, and cults develop around them. It becomes just a lot more difficult for us to create both political happiness and personal happiness, because I don't see how I can be personally happy when there are going to be laws on the books that affect my First Amendment rights. I don't see how I can be personally happy if the government has the right to affect how I conduct what I do in my bedroom with my partner, if I can end up in being arrested. I don't know how a woman can be personally happy, you know, Richard, if she gets pregnant and some governor decides that at 4 weeks, that piece of protoplasm, excuse my French, that's developing is a person.
Yeah. I'm noticing that we've already long ago lost economic liberties, and now people are starting to see what it's like to lose what's called civil liberties. That'll pinch more, I think. I think totally agree. Thank you so much, Jason. Excellent. Very helpful. Thank you.
Can I jump in for a second? I want to agree with Richard. And, you know, Jason and Richard, as intellectuals, we still have a lot more freedom to follow our ideas, express our ideas, engage with those freedom of assembly and so forth than people in business do and industry, because we're still living under a dichotomy between economic regulation and social. That's eroding, and that's been a problem over the last, certainly the last couple years, but it goes back a ways. And I just think, I just want to put in a word for the business people whose dreams and ability to make their own decisions about, I mean, their goals, like your goal in writing an essay or my goal in writing an essay, are part of their life plan and part of their dream of what they want to do with their lives is being suspended by the state to a much more radical degree than ours. So, but just a thought, just a observation on the degree of the intersection between personal happiness and political freedom.
That is true, David. I mean, that is so true, because I think as intellectuals, we have to remember that we just have a lot more leverage in that way. But business people for whom their creativity is no less artistic and no less instrumental in their conception of a good life, and that good life bears on how they make sense of not just the thematic construct of their lives, morally speaking, but an ability to carve out a sense of happiness is really, really compromised. I mean, if you just look at all the laws that George W. Bush created under his administration, the regulatory laws that constrain businesses. I'm not a business person. Jay can speak to this because Jay was in business while George W. Bush, and I'm not an enemy of George W. Bush, but I was aware of all the regulatory laws, I think, that he created for business people that must have had a dastardly effect on their capacity to enhance their businesses and therefore afford to your eye to lead a life of flourishing.
Just an add to that point, Jason and David, because it really is a case when business gets large enough, then they start using all of that as part of what they do to protect their turf, and it becomes, the whole cronyism that Richard has spent a lot of time, explaining. But the biggest cost of the cancel culture and the inability to speak truth and all of that, that's in big business. But in small business, it's really where the regulations simply inhibit any kind of, sort of startup development that's not backed with really serious money. But the small guy really, can't live to the thousands of laws they'd have to live to. So fully agree with the points made. Thanks.
Jason, would you say that would you categorize, or what would be the relationship between the phenomenon we observed during the lockdowns and mandates of rise in alcohol abuse, substance abuse, suicide, self-harming, depression? Is that political unhappiness because it was, you know, I mean, you could say it's was happening at the same time, but I would say it's caused by lack of social connection, feeling of powerlessness, hysteria, fear, out of proportion to actual risks.
Absolutely, Jennifer. That's what got me. The lockdowns and the mandates and all those things got me to, you know, it got me thinking about this project again, about the interface, about political happiness and the interface between private individuals and how they choose to interact among themselves as private individuals. And this, well, I can only think of the government in terms of negatives, in a negative sense, but this ghastly phenomenon called the state and how it intruded in the private sphere, in the private lives of individuals, through lockdowns, through all kinds of measures that then led, you know, to horrific consequences, you know, an epidemic of, we're already suffering from a sort of epidemic of loneliness, but a further epidemic of loneliness, of social isolation. Not all of us are spiritual giants. You know, some people take to the bottle, some people take to drugs. So I do think that, I'm glad you raised that point. I forgot to mention it, but the mandates and the lockdowns and just the arbitrary and sometimes not so arbitrary ways, the very, very thought out ways in which the government has chosen to, again, disrupt the interface between how private citizens make choices on their behalf to deal with each other, has definitely affected what I would call the sense of just not personal happiness, but the preconditions for something that we are going to call, that I'm going to call, the political happiness of individuals, which I want to make the stronger case later on, that the political happiness is a precondition for personal happiness. If you don't enjoy some semblance of political happiness, it's going to be very, very difficult. That is, that the state makes it very, very difficult for social conditions to be right for you to enjoy political happiness. It's going to be very difficult to carve out something like personal happiness in your life. It's going to take a very, very strong spiritual giant and a lot of compartmentalization. You're not going to be in attunement, and you're not going to be in flow. You're not going to be in engagement, as I talked about, to experience that kind of personal happiness. So, yeah, thank you for bringing up the mandates and the lockdowns. Yeah.
Well, and you know, in light of them, of course, it's very easy to fall into having a ghastly perspective on government, but a government that was, as our founders originally envisioned, securing our rights, securing our contracts, and securing our personal liberty, would provide that foundation for political happiness. So I'm going to toss it to Scott, who can tell us a bit about what we have in store. And thank you, Jason. Thank you very much, David, Richard, and John, Lawrence, Jay LaPere. Quite an honor to have you here, and everybody who joined our room.
Thank you very much.
Great. Quickly, Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern, Lawrence and I will be here on Clubhouse for a happy hour on the increasing double standards we see all around us. Then at 7 p.m. Eastern, also on Tuesday, Rob Trzynski will be discussing pathological altruism in the age of trauma. Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern, Rob Trzynski and TAS founder David Kelly will be discussing current events. Then Thursday, back on Clubhouse at 4 p.m. Eastern, Richard Salzman's topic will be presumed guilty, regulations versus rights. Great topics. I'm looking forward to next week. Thanks to everyone that joined us. We'll look forward to seeing you next week.